This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English programme, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Facing a chorus of global condemnation, Israel is confronting unprecedented isolation as diplomatic, cultural, and economic pressure is mounting. This was shown by a mass walkout preceding Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to the United Nations General Assembly. The incident symbolizes a broader international backlash against the war in Gaza, which is now manifesting in official state recognitions of Palestine and widespread boycotts of Tel Aviv.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has addressed the 80th session of the UN General Assembly. Before he began his speech, many countries walked out of the session in protest over the genocide in Gaza. Speaking to an empty room is another sign of Israel's growing isolation at the international community. This isolation is the price to pay for the regime's murder of innocent Palestinians and rejecting the global call for an end to the bloodshed. Netanyahu has acknowledged Israel's isolation, but he describes it as an unavoidable consequence of the Gaza war. Speaking this month at a conference, he called on Israelis to become more self-sufficient. He said Tel Aviv has no choice for the coming years, and it is required to deal with the isolation attempts. Global outrage over the dire humanitarian conditions in Gaza, including famine, has swelled in Europe and elsewhere as demonstrators demand that their political leaders do more to stop the crisis. In Italy this week, thousands of workers and students participated in a nationwide strike over Gaza that closed ports and some public transit hubs. The domestic pressure has played a key role in pushing European leaders to find a way to act. Several Western countries, including Britain, France and Canada, recognized the state of Palestine this week. Momentum is also building in the cultural space as well. Spain, Ireland and Netherlands have all threatened to boycott Eurovision 2026, the world's largest music competition, if Israel participates. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called for Israel to be excluded from all international sports, similar to how Russia was banned from the Olympics following the outbreak of the Ukraine war. In the US, more than 4,000 film workers, including A-list stars, signed a pledge this month to boycott certain Israeli film institutions. Despite fierce objections from countries across the globe, the regime is pushing ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza and attacks on regional countries. The regime struck several areas of Yemen on Thursday. Just this month, Israel attacked six countries, including Qatar. For now, it seems that while US backing may shield Israel from immediate diplomatic consequences, it cannot reverse the deepening global alienation. This international isolation appears set to intensify as long as the current policies persist.
Well, here are our guests for tonight's show. Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Faraz El-Najem, joining us from Toronto. And we'll also be speaking to Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joining us from Ramallah. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Al-Najm in Toronto. Please give us your perspective on how the Israeli Prime Minister was received at the UNGA this year, the mass walkout from members, the jeering and booing during his address, and of course the widespread condemnations from numerous speakers.
Yes, this is an unprecedented time that we see that the Zionist entity is losing allies, losing friends, and losing any type of support. Even the other systems or other governments that they have some, you could say, economical relations and some type of, benefits together are starting to pull away from the Zionist entity because of the massive amount of crimes and human rights violations and disregard totally to the international law. So this shows that Israel now is being isolated and truly it's the opposite picture of what Netanyahu tried to portray. Netanyahu portrays as if the GDP is growing and the economy is growing and that Israel is more beloved in the world, but the reality today showed in the United Nations that he has no friends and he's losing any type of support. And we are hopeful and hoping that more countries and more governments in the world pull away from the Zionist regime and pretty much suffocate it, exactly how they're suffocating the Palestinian children in Gaza. And it's quite clear the type of inhumanity that we're seeing today in Gaza and spreading also to Lebanon, to Syria, to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also even to the U.S. allies that rely on the U.S., such as Qatar, and we've seen when they bombarded the capital of Doha and a member of the GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council, and total disregard to international law, total disregard to a sovereignty of another country. It shows that Israel does not care about laws, and that's why the world should, at the same time, penalize Israel and also isolate Israel and make sure that Israel feels the suffering and the pain and what's happening to the people of Palestine for all these years.
Professor Nim, how do you view the massive international backlash against the Israelis, mostly, of course, due to the ongoing genocide and starvation in Gaza? And, of course, going over what Netanyahu said at the General Assembly and the threats that he made, it seems that Netanyahu and the Israelis, they live in an alternate reality where they are the victims and everybody else are the aggressors.
Good evening to you and to your guests from Toronto and to all your viewers. We were expecting this moment anyway, in a way or another. And I don't know if you remember, even on your screen, we talked about that one of the effects of the 7th of October, it will be an international effect. And we said that it will come not sooner, but generally, in midterm or, long term, generally. But apparently, it started now. And once it started, I don't think it's going to stop. To the contrary, it's more and more isolation to Israel because of the public. The public, in generally, in Europe, in all countries around the world, they couldn't handle this genocide and this country or entity or whatever we can call it, do all these kind of massacres and genocide and famine and starvation and the killing and ethnically cleansing in front of screens, and no one is going to do anything about it. So definitely there were lots of public movements and actions all over the world, and that by the end of the day will affect the governments and the countries. So bit by bit we are now building a kind of a consensus among all the world people against what the Israelis are doing, and we hope that we see more and more actions being taken by countries. I'll give you an example for that. Italy was always was supporting Israel, and even during the war. But what happened in Italy in the last week made the government take, you know, some actions, and especially sending two frigates to join the Floetta, the ships going to Gaza, and that is a change because of the power of the people, and what Netanyahu is doing more and more of the killing and insisting on going on in this killing, definitely more and more people are going to the streets and will take actions, and their governments will start taking actions. So I think that Israel is, putting the last nails in their own coffin in this way, and more isolation. He seems that he don't care. And in his speech the other week, he said, Netanyahu, he said that we have to close on ourselves, and we can do that, and we are able to do that. But apparently, they live in a world, and they have lots of investments and lots of money coming from different countries and lots of companies who are now boycotting Israel and all that, and especially the weapon. And all right. That now is going to take an effect on Israel, definitely.
Firas al-Najm, so many speakers at this year's General Assembly not only called for the immediate end to the genocide in Gaza, but they also called for the end of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and expressed their support for a sovereign Palestinian state. Please break down this common theme that we heard at this year's General Assembly.
You know, after 75 years that some countries are recognizing the Palestinian state and the Palestinian rights, such as Canada and Australia and Britain and France and some other countries that also jumped on board. But it's still something symbolic, I can say, that gives some credibility and more of a empowerment to the Palestinian people and to the, alienation, kind of treating the Palestinians as if they're aliens and they don't have any rights and they don't deserve rights and they have to truly fight for a basic right. This is a basic right of every nation, and the Palestinians have, been suffering for so many years, and we've been seeing the suffering on social media, on TV, and many people that are also from the region there, the Middle East region, West Asia, have also felt it directly because of family members, because of marriages, different things. It's time for the Zionist entity to fall. It's time for the occupation to be dismantled. It's time for the Palestinians to get their basic rights back and have their identity respected, and for justice to be served. Netanyahu is wanted by the ICC. He should not be speaking in the United Nations. This shows the United Nations lacks true credibility and accountability. They should be holding these people accountable, and they should not let somebody like this war criminal and the person that is truly massacring and killing the people in a very savagery way in Gaza, and everybody's seeing this. Even basic aid is not even being entered, not allowed to enter inside Gaza. This is not allowed in any law, in any book, in any history. And this is what Netanyahu is doing in front of the whole world. And for some reason, they're giving him impunity and a green light. But I think things are changing now, and people are sick. And even the politicians in Canada are sick of the Israeli crimes and lack of respect for any humanity and for the Palestinian people. And now we're also marking the one-year anniversary of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, this great leader that fought to support the Palestinians while they were left almost alone without any support. He supported the Palestinian resistance that is lawful, that is righteous, that is a right for any nation that is occupied under the United Nations law, that the people, if they're occupied, they're allowed to have legal armed resistance. And this is what Hamas did, and this is what Islamic Jihad did. And they have been caged up and been imprisoned for many years. And this was like a prison break and a way to hit the settlers and hit the criminals, in the neighboring cities. And Hezbollah supported, and Lebanon supported, and they dehumanize Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and they defame him and make him look like he's a terrorist and that he's inhumane. But this is the total opposite of the picture. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah helped the people of Gaza, helped the people of Palestine, and supported them. And this should have been the job of the United Nations. The United Nations should have sent in UNIFIL forces, as they did in Lebanon, to stop the war between the Israelis and the Lebanese. The United Nations should have adopted resolutions and immediate fast resolutions to support and protect the Palestinian people and the children and the women, and to have aid enter by all means and by force. But they do not do that. They enforce these laws and these implications on Libya, on Iraq, on Syria, and different countries, and Ukraine, supporting Ukraine and giving arms to the Ukrainian people against the Russian, as they call it, the occupation. But when it's the Palestinian people, they're disregarded and not cared about, and there's no support for them. But in this regard, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah had to step in, Hezbollah had to step in as a strong force to support the Palestinians. And they should be rewarded and respected for that.
Sure. Professor Nim, a number of European governments, as you also mentioned earlier, they're distancing themselves from the regime as a result of the Israeli crimes that they've been committing in Gaza and in the region as a whole. Some are even taking firm action, like Spain, which, if I'm correct, recently approved a complete arms embargo and further restrictions on trade linked to the illegal settlements, the settlement expansions in the occupied West Bank, which are illegal under international law. Could economic sanctions or boycotts against Israel soon become mainstream demands in Europe, in your opinion?
I believe yes. And I believe that also the European Union, who's taking now some of the countries, taking small steps like, you know, recognizing Palestine as a state, or doing here and there of some sanctions on Israel, or some personalities like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who are now banned in some countries to enter it. It is also a kind of a getting away from facing the main problem. And the main problem here, that their people are talking about eliminating this entity as a whole. They are talking about Palestine is free from the river to the sea. And this is really annoying for them. It means that they have to take more even action if they want to follow their public, and to take further also steps towards, you know, really punishing Israel. So far, no one imposed any kind of punishment on Israel. There are small moves here and there by states, I mean by countries, but not the real thing yet. Maybe Spain, maybe Italy, they are saying, Italy, especially the labor union in the ports, they said that we are not going to deal with any ship bearing, you know, weapon to Israel, either in or out, and the same with Spain. But we need to see even more punishment to Israel from the rest of the countries, the effective countries, at least to start with Britain, who just, you know, lie now bragging about, you know, recognizing the Palestinian state as if they did something, you know, but still have contracts with Israel to provide them with their weapon and parts for the F-35 aeroplanes, jets. And they are still sending that. France, the same. Germany, the same. So if you are still going and supporting Israel, and especially military-wise, it's really silly to say that, you know, what is the other actions? This is the first thing they have to stop. To stop sending arms to Israel, to have an embargo on Israel with the weapon, then other things are coming. But I believe that this moment is coming also, because the people are continuing in these demonstrations and in forcing their governments to take action, and especially that the Israeli entity, or this Zionist country, they are continuing with this genocide, and they are not stopping this genocide. And they are so arrogant, thinking that they have the support of the United States, and in this case, if they are protected and supported by the United States in all level, it means that they can manage, you know, even when Netanyahu talked about these, you know, countries that they are boycotting Israel now, and it became, you know, isolated somehow. He said it's okay, it's fine, because he believed that he can fix that later on, but now he have the United States. But to what extent the change is also occurring in the United States with the demonstration today, during the speech of Mr. Netanyahu in the General Assembly of the United Nations, addressing the empty seats, there were hearing the noise of the demonstration outside the building, demonstration against him and against Israel. So it means that it is coming, and the changes even in America is coming.
Firas and Ajim, a group of UN experts have called on FIFA and UEFA to suspend Israel from football events over its crimes in Gaza. How do you think international sports bodies and also their fans alike can take action to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza, bring about more attention to this genocide? In addition to that, former Manchester United star and football legend Eric Cantona, he pointed out a double standard enjoyed by Israel. He said 4 days after Russia started the war in Ukraine, FIFA and UEFA suspended them. But after over 700 days of genocide, Israel continues to be allowed to participate. Why is that?
It's very unfair. We've seen the way they're treating Israel compared to treating other countries that, do any kind of invasions or any violations or get involved in any military, projects anywhere in the region, in the world. It's all based on the interests of the U.S. and it's all based on the influence of the U.S. The thing is, if these organizations, such as FIFA and so on, go to the extent of removing Israel, not letting them participate, America will punish them somehow. And we've seen that with the ICC and other bodies that got involved to punish Israel, that the U.S. comes and steps in and, threatens with sanctions and also threatens to disregard them as an actual legal entity or a credible entity. And they'll start to defame them and threaten them from all different dimensions. And even the presidents of these organizations or any participants, they will be also punished somehow. And it's like a world mafia that we're dealing with as America. And the Israelis are the same thing. And they all work hand in hand to put pressure within the different lobbies that they have in different countries with the different politicians. And it's a very big monopoly and very dirty game that the Israelis play. But isolation is coming. We can see it. We've seen the walkout today in the United Nations. This has never happened in history to this level. That the world is getting sick of Israel. They should have got sick of Israel a long time ago because these crimes are just growing to a higher level with the intensity of the battle. Because Hamas started to gain more strength and more expertise, and they've been battling this evil entity for so many years, such as Islamic Jihad and all the other factions that are fighting alongside, resisting against the Zionist entity. And they are truly defeating the Zionist entity. And October 7th, truly, truly, if you look at it, has really exposed the Zionist entity and unmasked this evil entity, and also unmasked all these different governments in the world and organizations that claim that they care about human rights and international law and care about justice and all these different, categories that have to do with dignity of a human being. They look, after this battle of October 7th, it truly showed the real face of Israel and showed the real face of these people that are not truly working for integrity, for the justice of nations, for human rights, for liberty. And this is what they claim that they care for and they fight for. And sometimes they even impose wars on countries in the name of fighting dictatorship and fighting, human rights violators and so on. And they've done that in many countries, such as Iraq, when they came in with the excuse of nuclear weapons or chemical weapons, and then they invaded the whole country, and then later on they said we didn't find any chemical weapons. We all know that Israel has nuclear weapons. The world knows that. And the United Nations is busy trying to impose sanctions against Iran for having nuclear facilities, for technology, and for science. You can see the bias in that as well. And that's why there has to be more pressure, and the resistance of the Palestinians and the active of resistance that is supported by the Islamic Republic of Iran primarily has really shown the face of this ugly, evil regime, Israel.
One last question for Professor global demonstrations, of course, have been held ever since this genocide massacre started, including in the United States, of course, calling for sanctions on Israel and an end to U.S. complicity in the genocide of Palestinians. Americans are also not happy with their tax dollars. It keeps getting pumped into the Israeli war machine. Nation after nation, they're making their stance clear against what Israel is doing in Gaza. Where do U.S. politicians draw the line and say, okay, enough is enough, and we just can't support this any further?
Well, we know this kind of relationship between America and Israel, sorry. But yeah, it is coming. This enough is enough, because first of all, maybe the most important issue here, not only in the United States, but all over, also the European countries and Western countries who used to be an ally to Israel, that the taboo broken. The taboo of not doing anything to Israel and always supporting Israel and let Israel go ahead with all their atrocities against the Palestinian people and against other people in the region as well. Now this taboo of no one should talk, no one should criticize, no one allowed to criticize Israel, and this is anti-Semitism and all this stuff, this taboo was broken. Now people do criticize very openly and they are talking about it. And I believe that the most important thing, the changes which is now going on in the United States, and especially that people now starting to talk about AIPAC and its role in controlling the American government, and that the taxpayer in America are paying all this money. They don't have the services which is existed in Israel itself. And why should we pay our money to Israel to have all these benefits for their people, and we don't have these benefits for even our own sake? So I think now things are starting to boil again in the United States, and the boycotts and the sanctions are coming. The whole situation is a kind of a deja vu.
Sure.
Remind us exactly of what happened with South Africa. It started like this, bit by bit, but by the end of the day, the South African regime collapsed.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to my guest, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joining us from Ramallah, and also thanks to Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Faisal Najem, who was speaking to us earlier from Toronto, and of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and his pure, immaculate, chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I profoundly thank Almighty God for giving me the opportunity to attend this magnificent, comprehensive, meaningful meeting. I would like to extend my thanks to those who organized this event. Also, I would like to thank the brothers and sisters who presented various programs for an hour or so at the beginning of this meeting. The recitation of the Qur'an was good. The anthems that were sung were excellent in terms of both the poetry and the music. The elegy was very good, and the speakers spoke about very good matters. Almost everything that is in our hearts and in our minds regarding the Sacred Defense and its relationship with the people were mentioned by these ladies and gentlemen. Nevertheless, there is a need to reflect on and to think about these matters in order to find solutions, God willing. What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. We should understand this period and this important event properly and introduce it to future generations.
Subhanallah.
I strongly believe that if our succeeding generations learn about the important, meaningful aspects of the sacred defense and realize how the Iranian nation was able to reach the heights of victory in this important event and to stand up there with power and pride, they will learn great lessons from it and they will achieve great things. This is my firm opinion. The greatness of this event must be recognized. Much has been done in this field. Books have been written, films have been made, and memoirs have been narrated. However, in my opinion, there is still much more room for work to be done. Up until now, we have not been able to recognize or make known the details of this great, colorful painting. We are looking at it from a distance, but if we look at it closely, we will find that in every piece of it, there is so much beauty, so many fine points, and so much meaning and depth that one is amazed. Each piece of it is like this, and this information must be made known to people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
They named it Operation Rising Lion. They believed they could cut off the head of the Islamic Republic and the body would collapse. They dreamed of a second 1953 coup. But dreams dissolve in the light of truth. On June 13th, as Iranian diplomats prepared for talks with the Americans in Muscat, the Israeli regime struck without warning. Assassinations, airstrikes, cyber attacks. They wanted panic, they found patience. They wanted surrender, they were met with steadfastness. And the greatest surprise was not the enemy's cruelty, it was the nation's courage. From loyal supporters to the harshest critics, Iran became one voice, one heartbeat, one flag. This is True Promise, and I am Roya Purbagher.
It was supposed to be a masterstroke, a lightning blow that would leave Iran leaderless, defenseless, and vulnerable to foreign intervention. But instead, the events of June 13, 2025 marked the start of a war Israel could not win.
Breaking news in the Middle East and now escalating fears of an all-out war in the region. The IDF has confirmed Israel has hit nuclear targets. Officials say
in the middle of the night, Israeli fighter jets operating with U.S. logistical support struck Iranian territory in what they called Operation Rising Lion. Targets ranged from military bases and power plants to nuclear facilities in Natanz and Isfahan, even civilian neighborhoods in Tehran. The plan wasn't new. In 1953, foreign powers toppled Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh with money, threats, and sabotage. In 2025, Israel's calculation was that removing Iran's top commanders would shatter its chain of command and open the door to regime change. From General Qasem Soleimani to Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran has endured assassinations before, but this time, the scale was unprecedented. Simultaneous airstrikes, cyber attacks, and coordinated assassinations. Around 2,000 officials reportedly received death threats. Renounce the regime or your families will die. Not one surrendered. What Israel failed to calculate was the reaction of the Iranian people. Even the harshest critics of the government set aside political disputes. As bombs fell, there was no appetite for chaos. Instead, there was a wave of solidarity, a rare moment where political lines blurred in the face of foreign aggression. The bombs were not Israel's only weapon. As the missiles fell, another battle began. The battle for perception. On the very first day, the Israeli regime launched an information war. The message was simple. Famine is coming. Bread, meat, chicken, water, all will disappear. The goal was panic. The reality was patience. There were no raids on bakeries, no mobs storming supermarkets. The people stood by their government, determined not to create the very shortages the enemy predicted. From the second day, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and anti-Iranian outlets repeated the same fantasy, that unrest was brewing, that the streets would rise against the state. It was an invitation to chaos, broadcast day and night. Yet, the answer from the Iranian people was silence and steadfastness. In the cities under attack, families packed their belongings and left for safety. And in cities untouched by the bombs, strangers became hosts. Doors were opened, guest rooms offered. From the first day, towns across Iran announced readiness to house war-displaced families, a level of solidarity that left the world astonished. For 12 days, political disputes were set aside. The divisions the enemy counted on were erased. And in that unity lay the real defeat of the plan for a coup. Because the people had spoken, Israel was no friend, and foreign powers would not decide Iran's fate again. The so-called 12-day war would go down in history as a battle not only of weapons, but of wills. And the real big surprise was that Iran's greatest defense was its people.
To understand why these days reshaped the nation's sense of self, we must hear from those who live them on the ground. Joining us now is Dr. Mohsen Mohammadi Alamouti, University Professor of International Relations. Professor, it's a pleasure having you here. When the first explosions hit on June 13th, many were shocked, naturally, but I'm curious about your immediate thoughts, first and foremost, as an Iranian.
At dawn on June 13th, 2025, like so many others in Tehran, I woke to the sound of terrifying explosions shaking the city. My very first thought was, this is yet another test. Our people have endured so many trials since the Islamic Revolution. Coups, unrest, the long years of imposed war, endless crisis. And that night, I felt once again that this was a test of the Iranian people's unbreakable will.
As you pointed out, we have endured many things, and in the very first hours, our top commanders and key individuals were assassinated, yet our armed forces were able to regroup swiftly. How do you explain this resilience? Was it sheer discipline, or does it reveal something deeper, maybe, about Iran's military structure?
Honestly, in any other country, if such senior commanders, the ones who carry the burden of leading the defense and intelligence of the nation, were killed, the whole military structure might have collapsed. But what the Zionist regime did was beyond the rules of war. They targeted commanders who weren't even on duty, men sitting at home with their families, neighbors, and innocent civilians. They even went after our nuclear scientists. At first, one might think such strikes would shatter the defense system. But Iran's defense has something unique at its core. It's built on faith and the spirit of Islam. That spiritual strength, the soft power, is what held it together. Within hours, the leader of the revolution replaced the martyred commanders. The newly appointed commanders, many of them young, showed incredible courage. Let me tell you something. Starting an attack is one thing, but defending under fire when the enemy surrounds you with drones and warplanes is far harder. And yet, our youth gave their blood so that the tree of the revolution could grow stronger. They proved that we wouldn't do.
Indeed, it was so. And as you already know, Israel called it Operation Rising Lions. Now, it didn't go as they had planned. How could you help us understand the strategic logic behind this operation and why it failed?
It's clear what the Israeli regime was aiming for. Their leaders said it openly, and American officials too. They wanted the so-called regime change in Iran. They wanted Iran broken apart, brought to its knees. That was their real goal. But Netanyahu miscalculated badly. He thought by blinding Iran's radars, the eyes of the nation, and assassinating its commanders, the brain of the system, he could cripple us. He thought our people had lost faith in their own state. But within 10 or 12 hours, Iran struck back powerfully and in ways Israel never expected. By the third and fourth days, the balance of the power had shifted. And when Netanyahu, desperate, begged Trump to intervene, even American firepower could not tilt the scales. Iran's strike on the U.S. Al Udeid base in Qatar proved that our commanders and our people will never abandon the defense of their homeland.
It was a miscalculation because one of the most important aspects, if not the most important aspect of the 12-day imposed war was that critics and supporters of the Islamic Republic stood side by side, and many across the globe were even surprised by this overwhelming display of national unity. What does this unity say about Iran's identity under pressure?
Zbigniew Brzezinski, the American strategist, once warned President Bush not to attack Iran. He said, if you do, Iranian nationalism and Shia identity will fuse together and that will create an explosion. And that's exactly what happened after Israel's attack. We saw an extraordinary unity among Iranians, people from every walk of life. Those who once said, not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran, stood side by side with those who said, for Gaza and Lebanon, my life for Islam. Everyone stood together under one flag. even our athletes, without being told, gave military salutes in their games. Women athletes, too. It was spontaneous, heartfelt, and moments unlike anything in our history. The people understood more clearly than ever how unfair the world system is. They saw how the IAEA denies Iran even peaceful nuclear technology for medical and scientific needs, while turning a blind eye to Israel's hundreds of nuclear warheads. They saw the double standards. They saw the devastation caused by America and Israel in Syria, Iraq, Lebanon. All of it etched into our nation's memory only made us more united.
The soft glow of candlelight dances on tearful faces as the deep, steady flow of mourners gives the ceremony its sorrowful pulse. Tehran's main orphanage, Shir Khargah Amineh, a place where abandoned infants and children find care and hope, is now a cradle of grief. From the main street to the orphanage gates, people carry flowers and candles to pay tribute to the innocent faces of 47 children whose dreams will never take flight.
Today, together with other charity NGOs, we held a ceremony to honor the innocent martyrs of the recent Israeli aggression and to raise awareness about the situation of orphans living under such circumstances. We are calling for special facilities and support for these orphans, as they are even more vulnerable than other children, and many of them also have special needs.
Government officials, lawmakers, social workers, and ordinary citizens stand side by side. Even the president made a surprise visit to join the gathering and offer condolences.
One of the most important things we can do is keep the memory of these young martyrs alive. We will follow up with international organizations and demand justice for the innocent lives lost. These children are the children of Iran. Legal action is already underway, with the foreign ministry documenting evidence. We will pursue justice, even if it takes decades.
Among the crowd are children from other care centers, here to honor their peers.
The entire world has condemned Netanyahu, yet some countries continue to support this war criminal, allowing him to kill 47 innocent children in our country.
Each photograph hangs with a small doll, a silent echo of childhood stolen by warplanes and missiles.
The nation is still mourning the innocent lives lost. Yet amid the heartbreak, there's also a vow of unity. The collective sorrow has turned into resolve to defend the country.
A young guest steps forward before the crowd, taking the podium with a heartfelt prose she has written. Her simple words cutting deeper than any political speech. A lament for games interrupted and dreams unfinished. A voice that breaks the air, leaving many wiping away their tears. A reminder that while the attack tried to silence children's joy, it has only strengthened the nation's resolve.
As you said, there's an important factor that can't be denied, and that is the God factor. And I believe also that that is a factor that played an important role, not just in our victory recently, but over the years, it didn't allow us to collapse. Allow me to ask you one final question. If you were to capture Iran's message to the world in those 12 days in one sentence, what would it be?
The Iranian people stand firm. No threat, no bribe, no iron fist can shake them. As our leader has said, we never start wars, but if anyone dares to attack, they will taste a bitter and unforgettable response.
Thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure having you on the program. Israel called it rising lions, but in the end, it was the Iranian lion that rose, proud, untamed, and unbroken. The big surprise was not in their attack. It was in Iran's answer, a nation that cannot be bribed, bullied, or broken, a people who turned crisis into unity, a promise that when Iran is threatened, Iran stands as one. Next week, we reveal the other side of the story, the counterstrikes that shook the Israeli regime and the strategies that left the enemy with no safe place to hide. Until then, I am Roya Prabhakar. This is True Promise, and the truth cannot be bombed into silence.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.